Where are you from, mate? Where are you born?
Well, I was born in Tokoroa.
Tokoroa, yeah. Okay.
So I spent 12 months of my life in Tokoroa and then off to Mangatiroto.
Okay.
And then Auckland and Wellington all before I was five.
Okay.
So my dad worked in the railways. And so we moved around a little bit and grew up in an upper hut just north of Wellington. And started work with the Bank of New South Wales back in 1975, and did 32 years with the Bank of New South Wales that became Westpac Trust and then Westpac, and went from Wellington to Nelson to Napier to Hamilton, and ended up in Auckland in 1989. Jeez. And so we've been in Auckland ever since.
Wow.
So, saw a bit of the country. And
You move a lot, mate. Yeah.
And funnily enough, Hamilton was really quite a cool place.
Oh, okay.
So we ended up in Hamilton coming from sunny Napier.
Mm.
And ended up in Hamilton with our first daughter, or our first child. And my wife said to me, she said, when I told her that we had our marching orders with the bank from Napier to Hamilton, she said, you're not taking me and our, at that time, unborn child to that cold, old, foggy hole. And we actually really enjoyed Hamilton because it was the people. We were surrounded by people that were in almost exactly the same family situation as us, you know, recently married or recently in a partnership with young kids, and no money, so we had to make our own fun, and it was good fun. And then came to Auckland, and I said to my wife Cindy, I said, there's no way that we are doing to our children the moving around the country that happened to me. So we've been in Auckland ever since, and Hillcrest over on the North Shore. So our two younger children were both born in Auckland, so been there their whole lives.
Not used to that railway life.
No, exactly, and the bank life too.
Yeah,
So you know, with the bank, you tended to get your marching orders, and you know, hey, you're off to, you know, Ruatoria in 2 weeks' time. You know, get your stuff together.
What? Did you know much about how the railways were built back then? Like, what, did your dad ever come back with stories? Was it a bit more hectic than it is now, or an unsafe, or what was the?
Well, I think the railways back then was the backbone of the country. So my grandfather worked for the railways, my father worked for the railways, my uncle at one point in time, my sister and my two brothers all worked for the railways. So it was quite a railway family, and of course I said to my dad when I was doing the sixth form in Upper Hutt, the family moved across to Parramatta, and so I bought a motorbike and I commuted from Parramatta to Upper Hutt to finish my sixth form year, and of course finished that, got my UE, and I said to my dad, I said, well, look, I'm not going to do a seventh form, I'm not going to commute from Parramatta to Upper Hutt for another 12 months. So I might as well get a job. I said, I might as well, you know, join the railways. And he said, mate, he says, I'll get you a job on the railways, no trouble. But he said, I'll give you the tip. He says, I've seen a few broke railwaymen. He said, I've never seen a broke bank manager. So I started my career in the bank, and it was a really good ride. I enjoyed my time in the bank. So I did 32 years with Westpac, and I've been a mortgage advisor for the last 15 years.
Yeah, it is a lot of years. So how are you sort of seeing the banking industry change? Like, what was it like initially? I heard it was very counting heavy, where you had to, like, you know, rattle it off, and then you have a ledger that you check, and then someone has to check that you checked.
Yeah, well, I, you know, in 1975 when I started, I mean, the flashiest thing you had was a fax machine. And I did some time with the international department, and, of course, we had something that was flasher than a fax machine. We had a telex machine. So we could type messages that were instantaneously picked up in, you know, overseas countries and that. So, but certainly the technology has changed an awful lot in those days.
What,
or
like,
since those days?
Like, I've heard of, you know, they don't have much money in the bank at the moment. Like, just like if you wanted to turn up and get, you know, half a mil out, that probably wouldn't go too well. Has it always been like that, or?
It changes. I mean, the worst thing about the banking industry, I feel, is that the government gets involved in things that they probably shouldn't get involved with. I'm a firm believer in letting private enterprise be private enterprise, and we seem to have the government, you know, dabbling in issues and things that, you know, that they probably don't know an awful lot about, and don't consider the unintended consequences of, you know, of bringing in things like, you know, LVR restrictions, or take, for example, the, you know, Kāinga Ora, the first home loan. If you're a first home buyer, in my opinion, irrespective of how much you're earning or how much deposit you've got, you should be able to buy a house. And that's where, you know, I feel that the banks should be looking at the customer characteristics. You know, so if you're a stable job, earning good money, and you've been a good saver, and you've got a nice clean credit check, then that should be the first thing that the banks look at, rather than the security or whatever. So, you know, tip it on its head, look at the customer characteristics first. Is this person going to meet their financial obligations? And if so, you know, let's give them a chance.
So let's say you had the power. So you took over government. You could do a sweeping sort of banking industry setup and fix it all up. What would you fix, and how would you have it go?
Well, again, I'd look at those customer characteristics. If somebody's going to be a good credit risk, then they should be given more flexibility than somebody that has shown that they aren't very good with money, or again, you know, get them educated so that they do become better with money. So budgeting and looking at their credit check, you know, have they paid their bills on time? And those are the things that the bank does look at. So in that regard, the credit check regime is quite different now than what it used to be in the past. Back in the day, you know, you had to have a personal loan or a credit card or something like that to actually build your credit check. Whereas now, if you pay your bills on time and pay your loan payments on time, that actually builds a good credit score.
Yeah, there's sort of like a misconception that it's like America with your credit score. You know, you get your credit card and you keep paying your debt, and then you've got a better credit score. How do you get a good credit score in New Zealand? Is it just that, just paying bills? And do they take into consideration your Netflix subscription and say you can't get a house because you pay $20 a month?
Yeah, well, that was our the Triple CFA, the Consumer Credit Contracts Finance Act, that was a bit of a cluster mess. The government being involved with things that ended up with unintended consequences, and you're right, you know, the one-off things that that people had to, you know, like a car repair or a big restaurant bill or something like that, you know, suddenly it affected your debt servicing, whereas that's gone now. So I think we've as far as finance is concerned, I mean the biggest thing that you need to do is actually package your finance application to the bank in the strongest possible way. So you acknowledge if there are issues and be able to mitigate those issues. So if you changed your job, can we demonstrate consistency of industry, and can we demonstrate consistency of occupation? And if we can, then that mitigates the fact that you've gone from one company to another, but you're in the same role. And again, one of the other issues that we've got is that the boomers now that are getting into their 50s and early 60s, and of course they're wanting to borrow on 30-year loan terms. And of course, the bank's saying, well, look, you're 55 now. If you take out a 30-year loan, you're going to be 85 by the time the mortgage expires. So we've got to be able to mitigate that. So if you're 55 now, when are you going to retire? Well, look, I'm going to retire when I'm 70. So that means then that there will be 15 years of the mortgage left. If you borrow $700,000 now, that means technically you might have $350,000 remaining when you come to retirement age. So how would you anticipate clearing that. And you might say, well, look, I'll downsize the house, or I'll sell one of the investment properties, or hey, by that time I'll have $600,000 sitting in my KiwiSaver. So again, it's, you know, you've got to be able to present those issues to the bank and be able to mitigate them.
Yeah. What was like the first time you went in the, did you, like, what was the first moment when you started getting, I see it as sales, but, you know, some people, oh, dangerous word. But what was it like the first time you got your mortgage broking, like when you first got into it, and how, what was your plan to get business? Like, what was
well,
it?
Well, probably the best job I ever had in the bank. So I did, I worked my way up to branch manager position. So I was the branch manager at Hunter's Corner. And we ran three branches down there. We had the Hunter's Corner branch, the St. George Street branch, and the MIT. And then I got transferred up to Browns Bay. And again, we had a little hub there. We had the, that was when we became Westpac Trust. So we had two branches in Browns Bay, and then we had another branch in Mairangi Bay that I managed. And then I got transferred to Birkenhead. And Birkenhead, of course, was just around the corner from home. We live in Hillcrest, so... I used to drop my son James, drop him off at Northcote College, and then carry on up to the office. So it was really, really good. But in my last 7 years with Westpac, they offered me a job as a mobile manager, and that was probably the best job that I ever had. So we had our own lending authority, what we used to call our CAL, our credit authority lending, and we were able to actually make that lending decision with customers sitting in front of them, 7 o'clock on a Tuesday night. Hey, Ryan and Sarah, you know, this looks really good. I've approved that, so I'll get loan documents out to your solicitor tomorrow, and we're all good to go. Then the GFC hit, and they took away our lending authorities.
Yeah.
And so suddenly it was, hey, Ryan and Sarah, look, this looks really good. I need to send this away to our credit department tomorrow, and we might have an answer for you in 3 or 4 or maybe 5 days. And invariably, back then, the answer was no. And so I thought, well, look, I'm no better than a mortgage broker now, so I might as well be a mortgage broker. So I left the bank and started out as a loan market mortgage broker. And then, of course, a couple of years ago, we've changed our title to mortgage advisor now. So it was acknowledged that we don't actually broker anything. We essentially sell advice. Mm. And so we became mortgage advisors, and so that's how that turned out. But no, a mobile manager back then, I had my salary, and then we used to earn commission as well. And then, of course, the government decided that you shouldn't be result orientated. You shouldn't have your remuneration based on sales. And so now, as I understand it, the mobile managers just paid their salary, and they don't have any targets at all. So, yeah, I'm not quite sure that that motivates you really much, but there you go.
What like, you know, I don't know if you've heard the movie Big Short or anything like that.
Yep.
Yeah. What was it like on the ground at that time, you know, in the lead up to the GFC? Because maybe not necessarily in the bank that you're in, but like hearing, did you ever hear stories of people just, you know, signing people up that probably shouldn't be signed up? Or is that more of an American thing? What was it like in New Zealand?
In America, if you default on your mortgage, you can hand over your keys, and the bank takes over the mortgage, and you just walk away from your financial responsibilities. In New Zealand, if you default on your mortgage and the bank sells the property under mortgagee sale for less than what you owe the bank, you will be bankrupted for the difference. Hmm. And some people go, well, that's not really fair. And I'm sort of the opinion that, you know, if you don't meet your financial responsibilities, then you should suffer the consequences. So my brother and I, we argue about that. He likes the American system, whereas I quite like the New Zealand system. So I forget what the question was now.
It was mainly just to see if you saw some sketchy mortgages happening.
Like, yeah, and so I think by default, the Americans took, you know, as they typically do, they take a really, really good idea and ruin it. And of course, that's where they ended up with these home loans. You know, you ended up with these junk these junk bonds that that people bought, and of course they all fell over. It didn't happen quite so much in New Zealand. I think the banking system and the banking structure in New Zealand, I feel is a lot more rigid. Rigid's probably not quite the right word, but more stable. We seem to have more responsibility around our lending. So I feel that the banks do act responsibly in their lending decisions. And so I don't think I know that we didn't see quite the blood on the walls that we saw in the US.
What is like the banking system like in New Zealand in terms of comparison? Like, there's fractional reserve, like they don't hold a whole lot of money, but then they offshore. Like, I know it might be a simple question for your expertise, but it's like, how might you explain the banking system in New Zealand comparative to other areas in the world, maybe, or just in general?
Yeah, I guess the banks are just like any other retail operation. They borrow money at one rate and they lend it at another rate. So they've got their depositors. They take deposit funds at one rate, at one interest rate, and they lend it at another interest rate. They also borrow funds offshore, and obviously put a margin on those funds. So the banking system in New Zealand seeks funds overseas from the same markets that the other international banks and financial institutions borrow funds from. So that's affected by the swap rates and by the value of the currency. And so those cost of funds will vary from time to time, and also affected by our OCR and other handbrakes that the Reserve Bank might put on the flow of funds from time to time.
Could you explain the swap rates and official cash rate? Like, some people hear that and they'll be like, what gibberish are you speaking
about? Well, essentially it's the bank will go out to the market, and if you want to borrow $1 million, in simplistic terms, the bank goes out and borrows $1 million and then lends it to you. And that's where the swap rate comes into account. So that's where the banks have their cost of funds, and they put their margin on top of that.
Makes sense. And I've heard how the international community influences New Zealand a little more because we're smaller.
Yes.
What leads to a change in interest rates, like in terms of like what leads to the Reserve Bank making decisions on it, or what are international things that might impact the rate that they charge? Is it just the Reserve Bank?
The biggest issue with the Reserve Bank, or the biggest issue that the Reserve Bank feels that they have, is getting inflation under control. And really their mechanism to control inflation or affect the inflation rate is the OCR, the overnight cash rate. So by adjusting that, it obviously affects the cost of funds. The higher the OCR, the higher the cost of borrowing, and therefore theoretically the inflation should come down. The other thing, obviously, that plays a part in that is the employment or unemployment rate. So as the unemployment rate goes down, then the employees feel that they've got more control over their employers as far as being able to seek higher remuneration situations. And that, of course, drives inflation. So you've got those two things that really affect the interest rates. You've got the OCR, you've got the Reserve Bank on one hand wanting to pull inflation down. They've got a target of between 2 and 3%. We're running at about 6.5% at the moment, so it's not a good place to be. Having said that, our banking system is very robust. The pillars of our banking system are really the four big overseas banks, Westpac, ANZ, ASB owned by the CBA and BNZ owned by the NAB over. So those four banks, and people make the observation that, you know, it's inequitable that our main banks should be overseas owned. But I saw an article from Westpac the other day saying that there's actually 21,000 Kiwis that own shares in Westpac. Westpac paid something like $385 million in tax last year. So their financial year ended September, which makes them actually one of the biggest tax-paying companies in New Zealand. So yes, they are Australian owned, but they do give an awful lot back to the country. I mean, I think Westpac employs about 5,000 staff. They all pay tax and pay GST and contribute to the economy. So in that respect, I think we've got a very strong and robust banking system compared to some of the other banks. And yes, we don't have a deposit guarantee. So if a bank in New Zealand was to go bust, then as a depositor, you're actually an unsecured creditor. And so your funds would be released after obligations to the IRD, after shareholders. So you're actually way down the pecking order. Mm. And yet we haven't seen a bank in New Zealand go bust in living memory. I mean, BNZ had some issues a little while ago and they were bought out by the NAB, and Westpac had some issues back in the early 90s as well. Overall, the banking system is very strong and robust.
Can you explain a little bit about that, like, you know, getting paid last in the structure of, like, so we're putting money in the bank.
Yep.
The bank goes under and they're like, nah, tough shit, we don't have any money. Like, is it not very, like, backed by the government at all or nothing?
Not at all.
Oh, good. No. Let's console them. Put it under a mattress.
And I think people don't realise that, you know, but having said that, the Reserve Bank does have handbrakes on the banks as far as capital ratios that they need to maintain and that sort of thing. So I think we should take comfort in the responsibility that the banks do demonstrate to not make rash financial decisions.
What challenging with Westpac? What was the, were they lending too many people ran on the bank, like what, like everyone was lined up and they were with a bucket, where's my money?
Yeah, that was in the early 90s, and the share price crashed. I think they were down to about $3 a share, and I think it was Alan Bond came in from Australia and took a major shareholding in Westpac, put a couple of his people on the board, and steered the bank through those tough times. So I was only a pleb in the bank in the early 90s, so I wasn't really privy to what was going on in the high castle, but certainly it was pretty rocky there for a while, and those shares, you know, they went from $3 up to about $30 in a matter of about 12 months. So so that was the recovery.
What could, like worst case scenario, what would lead to everyone lining up outside, you know, a bank being like, where's my money, but there is no money? Like, what would need to happen, a sequence of events that would, you know?
Yeah, well, I guess every financial system in the world is really a house of cards.
You good, know, I feel so inspired today.
We've got a situation where a lot of the governments are actually printing money. And of course, you will recall that happened in Zimbabwe a long, long time ago, and a bit like the Deutschmark after the Second World War. You know, it was a billion Deutschmark or something to buy a loaf of bread, and the same thing happened in Zimbabwe. You know, they were just printing money, but nobody wanted it. Whereas the other economies, the strong ones, the US, China, Japan, and that, and to a degree New Zealand, you know, we're printing money, and I guess as soon as the world decides that these currencies are no longer backed by assets or an intrinsic value, then we would look to a, you know, to a collapse.
Good old Nixon, eh? So what is your take on the US dollar? Because it seems like they keep printing it, keep printing money, and then we'll just extend the ceiling. Do you have any fears of the US dollar? Because you seem quite knowledgeable on currency. I don't know why, but what's your take on the US economy? Is China going to take over? What's the...
Well, they are intermixed. The two economies, you know, China borrows money from the US. US borrows money from China. I'm not quite sure it's as simple as that, but certainly the zeros on some of the dollars that the US throw around. And I mean, somebody said to me the other day, you know, people talk about $1 billion, the City Rail Link, it's going to cost $5 billion or whatever. You've got to understand $1 billion is a big number. And I can't remember the exact number, but somebody said if you counted 1 billion seconds back from today, I think you're back to about 1957. So you've got to understand $1 billion is a lot of money. I mean, when I was a kid, all I ever wanted to be was a millionaire. And now $1 million hardly buys you a property in Auckland now. So we've gone sort of from $1 million, which was a lot of money, to $1 billion. That was even more, and now we talk about $1 trillion, $1,000 billion. So they are talking big numbers, and I guess when the world stops wanting to take those US dollars, then that's going to be a problem.
Do you think, like, if a person has no way to back a currency and they're incentivized to make sure people keep using it, they might be inclined to influence things in unfavorable ways? I guess this is a risky topic for you, but what was US strategy, would you say, to keep people using the dollar?
Well, back in the day, they had the gold standard. So every US dollar that was issued was supported by a dollar's worth of gold. So there was an intrinsic value, and I think the gold standard was removed in about 1933. So don't quote me on that, but it was sort of around that. So ever since then, there has been no intrinsic value to the currency. And so that's what I say, every economy of the world is really just a house of cards, and it could potentially come crashing down.
Oh, good. Comforting. What do we do? Do we just, make sure we grow crops in our backyard? How are you preparing for the potential apocalypse? Or you don't think about it?
Well, I do. I do. And I guess, when you've got kids, you not only think about yourself, you also think about your kids. And, we've been blessed with a little granddaughter now. So she's 2.5 years old. And of course, as well as my kids, I'm thinking about that generation as well. What's the world going to be like? What would happen if it did all fall apart? And I think in New Zealand, we're still going to have plenty to eat. We're still going to have plenty of sheep and cows and pigs and chickens and all the rest of it. And we're probably still going to have plenty of crops and that sort of thing. But the issue will be when you need a new iPhone or you need a new TV or you need a part for your new Tesla, then we're going to have issues.
So we're fine then. Food, what do you need? Who needs an iPhone?
Well, exactly. Yeah, go back to the old Bakelite telephone. Yeah.
What is your take on generations at the moment? Do you think they're soft? Do you think they're just another, like, people? I think it was Socrates, he was talking shit about the generation back then too. They lack work ethic. It seems to be just a thing. Like, as you get older and more mature, you're just like, oh, these young bucks aren't doing it right. But what's your take on the new generation and their challenges?
Yeah, I guess every generation puts their mark on the world. I mean, I was born in 1957, so I'm considered a baby boomer.
You broke the property market.
Well, we bought our place in fact I bought my first house when I was 21 in Wellington in 1979, and I paid 27,000 for that back then. When we came to Auckland, so we came to Auckland in 1989, and we bought an investment property up around the corner, or 3 or 4 years later, and we paid $135,000 for that, and it just recently got sold for $800,000. But back in the day, I mean, when I started work in back in 75, I was earning $3,750 a year. And to buy a property for, for $27,000. So I can't remember what my salary was, back in 79, and I suspect it might have been closer to, $4,500 or $5,000. So the multiplier back then, so if you take the amount that I borrowed, which was about 15,000. So 15,000, let's say I was earning five, so that's a multiplier of three. Whereas now, if you're buying $1 million property in Auckland and you've got a 20% deposit, you've got a $800,000 loan facility. If you're earning $100,000, that's a multiplier of eight. So it's certainly different times. People are earning more, but as you point out, the house prices have gone up.
What you talk about House of Cards. What's your thought on the houses in New Zealand, and what led to it being so expensive? And is it a bubble?
People want to live where it's convenient for them, and that tends to be within about a 15K radius of a main area like a CBD, like Auckland CBD, like Albany. Westgate and that sort of thing. So my middle daughter, her and her husband, they've just gone and bought out in Helensville. For $1 million, they've got 620 square meters and a GJ Gardner home for $1 million. For a similar price, they could have bought a three-bedroom townhouse in Westgate on 225 square meters. So, I've just had a customer. She's just bought out in Onehunga for $675,000. So, the one good thing about Auckland is that you have that whole spectrum. I can take you to a shop, and you can buy a business shirt for $10, or you could pay $1,500. And it's the same with a car. I can put you into a car for $500, or I could put you into a car for $1.5 million. And it's the same with housing. And that's one of the things that I do like about Auckland. People say, oh, it's too expensive to buy in Auckland. So, buy yourself a little apartment. $350,000 for a one-bedroom apartment with a car park and probably walking distance to work, and then in 4 or 5 years' time, when you've built up a bit of equity, hopefully the property's gone up in value, and you've paid off some of the principal, then use that equity to leverage into maybe your forever home and keep that as an investment property.
So on that, it sounds like you've dealt a lot with lending and property, so you might know a few things. Well, what are sort of the mistakes you see when people getting into investment property, and sort of the things that you've seen unravel, leaky homes and things like that, and yep. How to protect yourself against that?
Oh, I've had a lot of experience with that. So we bought an apartment in the CBD in Upper Queen Street. Or must have been 5 or 6 years ago, I suppose, knowing full well that it was going to need some remedial work. When we bought it, the remedial work was budgeted to be about $40,000. We ended up writing out a cheque for about $400,000 about 5 years later. So, we've had a bit of experience with that. But you really need to go into any investment with your eyes wide open, and investment properties are no different. Every investment does come with a degree of risk, and it's a matter of actually understanding what that risk is and looking at your personal financial profile and go, well, look, if the very, very worst thing happens, are we going to be able to handle the jandle? And I often say to people, the best time to borrow money is when you don't need to. So when, you know, if you're a couple and you're both earning good money, you know, have a $50,000 credit card limit. You know, have a $100,000 revolving credit facility, so that if one of you was to drop out of the workforce for whatever reason, and you couldn't work for, let's say, 12 months, you know, make sure you've got a facility there that you can make your mortgage repayments on time, and obviously keep your credit score intact. So, yeah, the best time to borrow money is when you don't need to. And so as soon as you've lost your job and you need to refinance or extend your interest-only facility, the answer is going to be no. You know, so that's where sitting down with a, you know, with a competent mortgage advisor right at the outset is quite a good, you know, learn. There's an old saying, you know, a fool learns from his mistakes, a wise man learns from a fool's mistakes, and that's where, you know, we've seen the issues happen, and generally speaking, we can set people up so that, you know, if the very, very worst thing was to happen, you know, can they work through it? So, yeah, setting your financial situation up right at the start in the best structure will set you up for life.
You talked about competent mortgage brokers. If I was coming in and I was trying to determine, let's say it was like a speed dating thing, but for mortgage brokers, and you had 10, and you're trying to differentiate between competent and incompetent, yep, or somewhere in the middle, what do you look for?
I think the best thing is to look at the Google reviews. You know, I've heard that if you've got less than 4.5 on your Google reviews, people don't want to do business with you. So I take pride in my reviews. I've got about 65 star reviews, and I think that's probably quite a good place to start. You know, looking at those Google reviews, and that will give you a bit of an idea. If you scroll down and have a look at some of the feedback, you know, that the mortgage advisor has got from clients, it'll give you a pretty good feel for that. Along with the social media as well, my assistant James, he looks after the social media side of that, and I'm not quite into all that, but he tells me that we need to have more organic stuff, so I need to go and get some carrots or some cucumbers or something.
This is technically organic, so you brought some carrots with
well
you,
there
mate.
We go, yeah. We've got some carrots and cucumber. Yep, yeah, excellent.
Yeah, okay. Well, and so I sort of get, you know, you get a mortgage broker, makes it easy because the bank's sort of, you know, they're restricted in what they can and can't say. They'll just say no, and they might not necessarily tell you why. And then also you need to do a lot of prep, and 6 months to do that prep and having someone support you is pretty good. What do you think people need to, I guess, get their head around more when they're presenting a mortgage? Like what's yep. the framework to...
Okay, so when you look at the bank's products and services, probably about 80% of what the banks do or what the banks offer is pretty generic across all of the banks. It's really that top 20% that differentiates the banks with their products and services. So all of the banks handle their revolving credit facilities a little bit differently. All the banks have different criteria when it comes to lending against apartments. All of the banks have different, even when you're self-employed, you know, we've got some banks there that won't add back things like depreciation and use of home office and interest and that sort of thing. And that can have a huge impact on your borrowing ability. So that's the value that a mortgage advisor can bring to the table, is actually understanding that top 20% that differentiates the different banks, and which is going to be the best fit for that particular client.
And what are you seeing on the ground at the moment? So I'm hearing stories of, you know, I used to be an investment advisor. I'm leaving now, but I used to say to people, you know, like, are you mentally prepared for your mortgage rate to go up to 9, 11%? Because, you know, that's happened in the last few decades. What are you seeing on the ground in terms of people came in with the expectation of 3%, they'll sold the dream, then all of a sudden it's coming that they're going to have to refix it at a different point. Yep. What's the market like in your opinion at the moment?
Well, I've obviously been in the financial sector for an awful long period of time, and we've seen interest rates over 20% in my lifetime, and I've seen interest rates at 1.99%. So we have seen that spectrum, but when the interest rates were at 20%, inflation was running at about 20%, and when we saw the interest rates at around the 2-2.5%, we saw inflation at, like, you know, between 2-3%. Now we've got interest rates up around the 6-7%. I mean, you know, some of the floating rates are now over 8%, but we've got inflation running at 6.5%. So people feel wealthy when their assets are appreciating in value. And I guess the biggest asset that most people have is their home. So, I mean, you know, when they see the value of their property going up, then they feel an awful lot more comfortable about handling the higher interest rates. So, yeah, I must admit we've spent quite a bit of time over the last 12 months helping a lot of customers with structuring their loan facilities, particularly people that are self-employed and maybe in commission roles, like car salespeople, real estate agents or real estate salespeople. So we've had to help a lot of those when the commissions weren't coming in. We've had to restructure them so that they're able to meet their financial obligations, and that might have been moving from principal and interest to interest only for a period of time, or taking a repayment holiday if they had a buffer there between the amount that they're entitled to borrow, so the limit versus the current debit balance. If there was a buffer there, then we've been able to take a loan repayment holiday to work through those tough times. So yes, there's been a lot of that happening over the last 12 months, and of course we don't get paid for that either. So that's no fun, but it is. It's all about looking after the client and making sure that they do come out of a bad situation, not looking too bad.
And do you think New Zealand's in a bad situation now? Is it a recession? What do you think?
The New Zealand economy is two things. It's very small, but it's very robust. And so I think we actually handle the financial bumps an awful lot better than some of the other countries, some of the other economies.
Well, what do you think makes us robust?
We're a young country, and so we've been able to build our country working with the good things from all of the other economies, like our legal system. We've been able to take the good stuff from the US, the good stuff from the UK, the good stuff from some of the other countries, and build a very strong and robust legal system. Same with our banking system. We've been able to take the good ideas from all of the other countries and build a good, strong, robust banking system. And so all of our systems, we've been able, or all of our processes and systems and that sort of thing, we've been able to build with the knowledge and experience that the other countries have been. So we've sort of sucked all the good stuff, and I feel that we've built quite a strong country and quite a strong economy.
Learn from the fool's mistakes, huh?
Correct.
Cool. Well, you've just done a whole podcast, mate. So
how about that?
Yeah, congrats. Thanks for coming on. And
that's very good. Well,